And now I'll turn it over to our moderator, ALEO's Executive Director, Ben Johnson, to start us off. Ben?
Thank you, Bill. Welcome, everybody. My name is Ben Johnson, Executive Director at AILA, and I am very excited to have for you some experts on immigration law and policy to talk about this recent proposal from the Senate. Today, we have Jeremy Robbins, the Executive Director of the American Immigration Council, Greg Chen, the Senior Director of Government Relations here at AILA, Andrea Flores, the Vice President of Policy and Campaigns at Forward.us. Those will be our primary speakers. We also have backup experts in the form of Chev Dalal Dehaney, also Senior Director here at AILA, and Angela Kelly, Senior Advisor here at AILA, just in case there's questions that only they can answer. All right, so let me start off just with some overall framing, something that I think you'll probably hear everybody on this call say, which is that the current situation is untenable with regard to immigration policy, particularly the challenges that we face at the southern border. The funding and infrastructure is just inadequate to meet the challenges that we face. And legislative reform is critical to meeting this moment. And we know in the current environment that the only chance for legislative reform is a bipartisan proposal. So the refusal of House leadership to engage in any kind of bipartisan effort is, to use their terms, a dereliction of duty. It is unacceptable for the House of Representatives to ignore their constitutional mandate to oversee immigration. And while I know you will hear lots of concerns about this Senate proposal, I believe that the people that were willing to get in this room for as long as they did to hammer out differences, to come to come some kind of consensus around what needs to get done, what needs to be done, is something that we have to commend. It's not easy to do politically or from a policy perspective, and it's something that we need to do a lot more of. There's a lot of chest thumping in immigration, a lot of outrage, and not enough solutions. So I think the fact that we've got people willing to get in the room and come up with solutions is really critical to, again, meeting the moment that we face. The Senate proposal should be, quite frankly, the beginning of that process, not the end. I view this proposal as the opening of an opportunity to get the reform we need. But to get there, at the end of the day, we're going to need a lot less dangerous and, quite frankly, inaccurate language from politicians around this issue and around this particular proposal. And for example, President Biden is wrong to be calling for a shutdown of the border. That's not what we need, and that is not what this bill would allow. Equally, Speaker Johnson and the Freedom Caucus are wrong to say that this proposal would allow or sanction 5,000 undocumented immigrants coming into the United States every day. And they are completely irresponsible and out of touch in their expectation that immigration reform can only happen with zero border crossings. That kind of political posturing is not what we need in this moment. We need more people coming together to build consensus around what do we need to do, what can we do, and how do we do it. So let's begin now in terms of an assessment of both what we need and an analysis of how far or how close the Senate proposal comes to what we need in this moment. So Jeremy Robbins, let me begin with you, and you can start to dig in from here.
All right. Thank you, Ben. And thank you all for joining. As Ben mentioned, I'm Jeremy Robbins. I'm the executive director of the American Immigration Council. And I very much agree with Ben that the starting point here is that our system's untenable, right? And that it wasn't designed to address the flows that are coming now. And it's certainly not prepared to address after 30 years of underinvestment and lack of serious bipartisan work to reform it. So ultimately, the idea of a bipartisan effort is a great step forward. Ultimately, our position at the council, and I'll talk to you about why, is that while this bill does a great job of identifying a lot of the right problems, the solutions it offers miss the mark as often as they hit it. So there are three things I want to talk about. So I want to talk about the parts of the bill that I think actually would materially help in managing the system as it comes. The parts of the bill that either don't help or actually affirmatively make it harder to manage. And then what's missing? Like, what are the things that actually would give us a manageable, fair, orderly border that aren't in this bill? So I'll just touch on them quickly, and then I'll pass it to Andrea and to George and to Greg to go deep on their views. So what's in here? What's going to help? First and foremost, making the decision take months and not years is a hugely important thing in having a manageable thing. If you come in and you're not reaching a decision for 7 years or 5 years, that's not real justice, that's not a real system. We need something where people get to merits. And this does it. You have to have your fear interview within 90 days of inspection. There are real risks in that I'm going to talk about why that fast process only works if it's fair. And I think there some of the omissions in this bill are going to make it sort of less likely that'll be fair. But the idea of getting to a decision much more quickly is fundamentally important. And this is an effort to do that. One of the things that to make it fair is that you're going to need legal representation. And there is in this bill guaranteed legal representation for minors 13 years and younger. Now, it's not expansive enough to be for everyone, because I think the reality is if you can give people representation so that they can figure out how to articulate and navigate this system, it can go a lot faster. The other thing I think it does, which is in terms of using the resources well, is that it really invests in alternatives to detention, right? So we're gonna make this happen, not trying to have an unfair process, not gonna work at the border, but there are gonna be real investments in doing this in a non-custodial setting where people can really assert their rights, and then you can get it to go faster. So I think those are a big step in the right direction. A second step in the right direction is there needs to be an actual line for people to get in, either for asylum or for other pathways. And so there are investments in actual processing of asylum at ports of entry. There's a statutory minimum now of 1,400 people a day for processing at ports of entry. There's funding for 4,000 new asylum officers. And there's more money to try and figure out so that if we want people to come to ports of entry and make their claims there, we're actually starting to get to a system where you could do that. Though again, as I'll mention, I think that falls short for a bunch of reasons too. But going after that problem of if the goal is to get people to make their asylum claim at a point of entry, we need to have a point of entry where that's functional. Second is there need to be pathways. A lot of people are coming. They don't understand our asylum system. They're coming here to make a better life. And what this bill does, it starts to create some avenues for people to come here outside. Instead of forcing all the people who want to come here through a broken asylum system, it creates other channels. So there are 50,000 visas for family and employment for the next 5 years, so 250,000 total. They deal with problems like the aging out of documented dreamers, there's path for Afghans. These are issues that have huge and broad bipartisan support, and you see it hyper locally, whether it's Republican or Democratic mayors or governors who see their severe labor needs and recognize that immigration is a part of that. And so I think that as you think about reforming the system, that's a hugely important thing to be part of it. Recognition of the parole authority, similarly, of like if we want to relieve pressure on the border, recognizing that the president has the ability to parole some people in certain circumstances is going to relieve some of that pressure. And then the last one is really trying to say, all right, looking at this as just the border is an inadequate way to look at it. We need to look at it. What happens when people after they get here? And so right now you're seeing this in cities across the country that are straining when people arrive and aren't able to work. And so this is alleviate some of the pressure on cities with some funding, though not enough, and by getting work permits automatically once you meet the requirements, instead of making you wait 6 months. Think about what it means for a city when someone arrives but can't work and there's not actual federal assistance to help that person, what kind of a strain that puts on city budgets. Then there are things that would hurt in this bill. So you look specifically, I think the biggest one, and I'll let Greg and Andrea drill down, but the biggest one is the summary removal. It's a hugely blunt instrument the way this is drawn up. So not only is it so blunt that it's going to catch people who would have valid asylum claims who now you have to firmly manifest it or you're not going to get it, but it doesn't actually act as the deterrent that it's promised to be, even though it's this blunt instrument. So because you're not actually going to know most likely if the deterrent authority is in effect, right? DHS it doesn't have to, and for all sorts of reasons, like not tipping off the cartels, isn't likely to announce whether the expulsion authority is in effect on any given day. If you're a migrant, how are you going to be deterred by that? So I think things like that are a huge problem, and I know we'll talk about more of those. And then finally, I'll just very quickly, things that I think are hugely important that would help that aren't in the bill. So investing in root causes, like we need to look at both push factors and pull factors. We need to invest in why people are coming and what we can do to address it. That's a long-term investment we need to make. Second is much more significant investment in border processing. So we talked about immigration attorneys for kids. If you provide immigration attorneys to people who need them, the system can go a lot faster and it can still be fair. The statutory right now, there are 1,400 appointments on CBP1 at the border to process people. That is far too few for the flow that's coming, right? If you don't want people to come, or except through ports of entry, you need to make ports of entries work. And part of this is there. If you look in this, they're taking a lot of the cases are taken away from immigration judges. And so I think the assumption is that would decrease some of the demand, but there isn't a ton of money for immigration judges and what there needs to be if you want cases to go faster too. And then the last, if you don't do all these things, what's going to happen is people are going to start pooling on the Mexican side of the border, which happened during Remain in Mexico and some of the other Trump era policies. And the danger of that is huge. So we need a real plan for what happens when people start dealing with that. Because there are a lot of assumptions in this about what the Mexican government will do that are not borne out by factuality. Third thing that I think the bill is really missing is looking beyond the border and really making deep investments in communities. We've proposed in our border solutions papers a center for migrant coordination. So if someone's getting released into society, there should be a proactive coordination between the federal government and the communities where they're going so that communities aren't surprised when people are coming, they're ready and they're making a plan. The fact that doesn't exist is a huge missed opportunity in dealing with this flow. And the second is the money, which is a huge bill with tens and tens and tens of billions of dollars. There's just too little money to help cities, which is less than $1 billion that actually goes to cities. That they're going to be absorbing the flow. We need to invest in that to help it. And then the final thing that's missing in terms of relieving the valve is a real line for people to come in. The additional work permits are nice. They're not enough for the flow and for what our economy needs. And the path to legalization for people who have been here a long time, if we want to take pressure off the system so that we can really invest in processing and managing the flow, we have to do those things. So that's a quick overview of sort of the what works, what doesn't, what's missing. Looking forward to talking more, but I'll pass it now to, I think, Greg.
Thanks, Jeremy. Greg?
Great. It's good to be here. And I will jump right in where Jeremy and Ben essentially left off. Just firstly by acknowledging and stating clearly, you know, solutions are urgently needed here. Reform both the broad immigration system and also to bring greater order to the border region and also to process migrants more rapidly, efficiently, and fairly. And it may be surprising, but, you know, AILA is clear in the recognition that the system needs to work effectively. And for people that are not eligible to stay, that may include a final decision that they need to be removed and finding a safe and humane way for them to get there. And the question is, does this bill move us in that direction effectively? And the bill is probably the most extensive border funding and security package that we've seen in decades. These are massive resources that will be given to DHS and other immigration agencies on the order of essentially $20 billion. On the enforcement end of things, this will create new executive powers that will restrict the flow of migrants and asylum seekers arriving at the U.S. southern border and will accelerate the asylum processing and result in rapid removals of people, as Ben and Jeremy also flagged. I'm going to focus in on particularly the Border Expulsion Authority and go into some detail on this. So this new authority, when it takes effect, will bar access to asylum for people that are entering between ports of entry. And then it would rapidly expel those people who are apprehended between ports of entry. What's the effect, the trigger that would actually put it into effect? It's done when encounters at the border reach a certain level. And so when daily levels reach 5,000 over a 7-day average, DHS is mandated to apply this border expulsion authority. At a lower level, if it reaches 4,000 per day, then DHS would have the discretionary power to use it, but is not required to use it. And then finally, there's a single day trigger, which is if on a single day, the encounters reach 8,500, then it's mandated that the trigger must come into it, or the expulsion authority has to come into effect. The broad effect of this overall power is that it's going to be coming into effect very soon after the bill is implemented, or if it becomes law, because the encounter levels are already exceeding the levels that I just described. And what is going to happen in the long term? From our viewpoint, it's likely to foster more crime and violence at the border rather than to improve order and security, because asylum seekers are still going to come to the border and they'll wait there. And we'll see the kinds of encampments that we did during Remain in Mexico and Title 42 during the Trump administration also happen on the Mexican side of the border. And unfortunately, as we saw back then, these encampments will probably not be they'll be unsafe and unsanitary. Cartels will likely prey upon these individuals. And so we'll have an increase of crime and violence due to that. It's also not clear that it's going to be an effective deterrent. Jeremy touched upon this, mainly because asylum seekers are still going to want to come, and they won't know when the border's open or when it's shut, and when they won't be able to access asylum if they're caught between ports of entry. They may not even know about the law at all, which polling has shown that asylum seekers, when they're coming, don't really understand the nuances of U.S. asylum law very well. This is not a shutdown, though. As Ben actually flagged before, this expulsion authority is not a shutdown, because ports of entry will remain open for people with U.S. passports and visas. And as Jeremy mentioned, there's a minimum number of people that can still access asylum coming in at ports of entry. It's 1,400 per day. The other thing that I will flag is that when somebody is apprehended between the port of entry, if this expulsion authority has been triggered, they can still request two other limited forms of relief that are similar to asylum. One is called Convention Against Torture, and the other is called Withholding of Removal. Those are complicated sounding names, but they're a kind of humanitarian protection. The person actually has to proactively express that they want this protection. It's not like CBP is automatically going to screen them if they're apprehended. And the downside to these protections is that they have a higher standard, a higher legal standard to meet. And they also provide more limited protection to the person who receives it. So that's a downside. But there is some kind of a protection for people that are apprehended between ports of entry, even though they cannot get asylum. The other major asylum-related provision that I want to highlight is the new method that is going to be put into place for people that are coming in at ports of entry, not between ports of entry, but at ports of entry. And this is a new expedited process. And what this process will do is it's going to rapidly screen asylum seekers within a shorter period of time. Essentially, 90 days is the goal here. And asylum officers will be doing the initial screenings, as is done in many of the cases now for people already coming in under the current system. But in addition, they'll be moved along more quickly through the process. The people being screened won't have the chance to come before an immigration judge, which, as you may know, the immigration courts are severely backlogged with millions of cases. And that's one of the delays that makes it more difficult for people to get finality in their cases. So here we're going to have asylum officers do the first screening and then do the actual full decision on the case. And if you want to appeal at either one of those stages because you're denied, you would not go before a judge or ever a federal court. But instead, you would come before a board comprised of asylum officers. So the idea here is to resource this more with USCIS asylum officers rather than judges, and not to have the recourse to the federal court system. The people that are coming through this process, and when they enter, when they come to the port of entry, DHS has the power to either say, okay, we're going to have you go through the court process, or we're going to have you go through the existing expedited removal process. These two already exist in law, or this new third process. And so DHS will now have yet another tool in its toolbox to speed the processes along here. And so ideally this goes faster. And the other thing that it will do is it will require that people be put on alternatives to detention when they enter. And this will increase the monitoring and supervision of people to ensure that they appear for their hearings. And so the idea here is that people don't just get released into the interior of the country while they're waiting, even for, let's say, a shorter period of 90 days, but they will be monitored and tracked by the government. And so that way, there's assurance that people will comply with the process overall. There are two heightened kind of asylum restrictions placed. You probably heard about raising the asylum standard. So the preliminary screening, which is often referred to as the credible fear screening, an initial screening for whether or not you might even qualify for asylum, that standard is going to be more strict. That was widely reported as something that would be included way back in the fall. That is, in fact, included. And then there's a new asylum bar that's going to be codified, which essentially would mean that if there's a reasonable chance that you could be relocated inside your home country, then you would not qualify for asylum. So if there's a reasonable chance you could be relocated and not face persecution and that you would be safe if you're relocated, then you would not be eligible for asylum. So those are the two or major areas of asylum that I'll focus on. And in quick summary of that part, I will just say that the rapid and truncated procedures will in fact undermine the fairness and the thoroughness of asylum screenings and likely will send many legitimate asylum seekers who should qualify for protection back into unsafe situations. And that's just kind of an undeniable fact of what this package includes. That being said, while this is a huge border enforcement package, it's not an enforcement-only bill. There are several items in here that Jeremy mentioned most of them that will, in fact, improve the system. And so I'll just mention them again, just so they're in the back of your mind, but we can answer those questions if you have them. Jeremy mentioned there's more a one-time infusion over 5 years of more green cards for families and for employment purposes. Legal representation will be guaranteed and paid for by the government for children 13 and under. And there is going to be a pathway to legal permanent status for Afghan allies that fled from the Taliban. That was a promise we made to our allies, and it's included here. And so those are some of the key items. I won't go into detail here. The one thing I will flag is the funding aspect. And so I mentioned at the beginning that this is $20 billion. This includes funding for ports of entry to be much more capable of managing the flows, $4 billion for USCIS to reduce case backlogs and also have asylum officers process cases, more immigration judge teams, and also more resources for localities, for cities, to be able to provide temporary assistance to migrants that come into their cities, be they the city at the interior or at the border region. So those are the overall elements of the package. And the last two things I'll say is what is missing. Jeremy touched upon a little bit of this, and I will flag one thing that he mentioned and then a broader one that I think he did not mention. One is the bill does not include enough green cards and other legal pathways. And this is an area that we have businesses. We have Republican governors, Utah and Indiana, they're asking for this. They need more people to come and work in the United States. We have a labor shortage, and the future prosperity of this country depends upon more foreign workers. And so we have this odd mismatch policy-wise of the need for immigrants to come here to keep our country running effectively and sustainable and thriving, and yet people saying we can't have any more people come in. That's a mismatch, and it doesn't work. And it's because of primarily inconsistent politics, not policy. The last thing is legalization. There is widespread, overwhelming support among American voters, whether you are red or blue, that the solution for immigration has to protect people who are dreamers and who don't have legal documented status or who only have a temporary status. That should be included. It's not here. And so that's where these conversations need to keep going in that direction after these bill conversations happen. I'll stop there.
Thanks, Craig. Andrea?
Thanks so much, and thanks for joining. Just a reminder, my name is Andrea Flores. I'm the Vice President of Immigration Policy and Campaigns at Forward.us. So our position at Forward is ultimately that this is not necessarily an immigration compromise bill. And the reason why it is not is the way that it started, which is that the administration asked for critical funding to enforce current immigration law, and they haven't gotten it. And so instead, these negotiations started as a way to free up necessary funding to enforce our laws at the border. Now, with that said, it is an important starting point for Democrats to articulate a vision for how to both preserve the asylum system and reform the asylum system. Because at Forward, we believe that the status quo is unacceptable. I grew up in a border community and I have major concerns about what we have been seeing over these past several years that are in part a result of how we've been processing asylum seekers, especially for the last decade. We have known since 2014 that the majority of the people who are now coming to the border may not meet the high legal standard to receive asylum. But it has taken 10 years for Congress to take that seriously enough to start asking the difficult question of how do we process both asylum seekers and people who are coming for other reasons. But a critical failure of this approach actually reflects the last 10 years of why border policy has not righted the ship and has not improved conditions at the border. And that is, this bill continues to preserve the asylum system as largely the front door of our immigration system. It still assumes that most people in our hemisphere who are migrating, who are forced migrants, still have to come up to the border to seek relief. And actually, I want to point out that one thing that's interesting in this bill is while it's preserving asylum system in this way that we know doesn't actually work well for anyone, I don't think that any organization should say that a family should have to trek and use a smuggler to come to the border to seek relief. That is an archaic system and one that we should be reforming and directing those people to safer legal pathways. So what is this bill primarily missing? It's missing those legal pathways that would actually reduce pressure on the asylum system and actually make the reforms in here operationally work. Because some of these reforms are really important. It should not take 6 to 10 years to resolve an asylum claim. We should not be forcing people to not be able to work legally and have to rely on cities and states to support them when we admit them into the country. Those are critical and important changes. But we should also not expect most families to have to use a smuggling network to seek asylum. Instead, we should be providing new pathways that are for people who want to work here, people who want to reunite with family, and people who may have protection needs that don't actually meet the level of an asylum protection. And so until you start seeing Democrats really own and put forward a lot of those positions, we're going to continue to have many of the same operational challenges at the border. And here's why. As my colleagues and partners here have said, this is not really a border shutdown. It still requires a fair amount of processing to happen, even between ports of entry. And we know that many of the conditions we have seen is because it is very easy for the small, old, outdated facilities between ports of entry to quickly become congested and for then people to be released due to that congestion. And so once again, I'm very concerned that we're preserving sort of a system where there is a process that ports, but it's limited. And that smugglers will continue their pattern that we know that they've done after every single new asylum restriction has been rolled out in the last 10 years. Smugglers have adjusted by sending more people between ports of entry, overwhelming border patrol facilities, and then therefore people have to be released because you cannot safely keep human beings in conditions that of their confinement that we see in many of these old, outdated border patrol stations. So does this fix the problem that these negotiators set out to fix? Not necessarily, right? Because you are not reducing the number of people who are going to use the asylum system. However, it is critical that there is bipartisan agreement and that there is not a new restriction on the president's parole pathways. I think that there's an important recognition by Leader McConnell, by Senator Lankford, that these parole pathways are the future and that they've redirected migration away from the asylum system and in towards a more orderly process where Americans are sponsoring would-be migrants and helping them come here and helping them work. And you don't see that population right now in the cities being unable to work. You see them dispersed in an orderly manner, working, reuniting with family. That's the type of system that lawmakers should be building. And they should use this as a starting point to actually build a system that has more people come in, whether that's through private sponsorship, whether that's through a jobs program, whether the orderly ways that reduce the humanitarian crisis that is people having to use smuggling networks to use our immigration system. So that's how Forward is reading and interpreting this bill at the moment. We are hopeful that leaders and our longtime immigration champions, especially those who've been left out of this process from the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, can start to inform and shape this proposal and put in those legal pathways that we're missing. But I also will say that without legalization, while that is a difficult political goal to reach in this moment, Democrats have to keep fighting, whether that's for Dreamers, whether that's for legalizing some of the undocumented, because it is not the only election year issue that the border right now is in need of reform. We have also, as every partner on this call has been fighting for real legalization for the undocumented. And as we look towards 2025 and what will happen to DACA recipients most likely at the Supreme Court, when DACA is most likely ended, that conversation has to start now, and it still has to be as urgent as fixing the asylum system, as fixing the border. So happy to answer more substantive questions, especially around how processing will impact border officials on the ground. But ultimately, we do believe right now this is the wrong approach, but it is a start, and it's important that Democrats put forward solutions. And at Forward, we'll continue to actually be articulating what President Biden can even be doing today to change what we're seeing in cities and to change what's happening at the border, because they do have options. They do not have to wait for Congress in this process to start providing immediate relief to communities like Denver, Chicago, and Boston. And the most immediate way they can start is an idea that Jeremy had already raised, which is actually beginning to federally coordinate the arrival of asylum seekers to ensure that people who do not have housing or people who may not have a sponsor are actually getting to communities that can receive them. That could be a major change that could happen this week. And we will continue to push for that, as well as continuing to push for better asylum policies.
Excellent, Andrea. Thank you very much for that. I just do want to underscore that not only the bipartisan recognition of the role of parole as a legal mechanism, but also the inclusion of additional visas, I think is a further recognition, a bipartisan recognition of the role that that can and should play in matching up these, as many people recognize, not asylum seekers, but economic migrants, matching up those economic migrant patterns with labor needs in the United States. It's at least a start in terms of recognizing that. I also want to quickly point out that there are a couple of other protections in here, or recognitions in here, age outs, for children in H-1B status. That's something that Chev knows very well. If there are questions about those particular provisions, same with green card backlogs and pathways to citizenship for military personnel. So again, some recognition of, you know, the tenets of or the principles of comprehensive immigration reform that that might get a proposal over the finish line, but certainly a much more downsized version of that. All right, Belle, let me turn it back over to you, and you can be the one that navigates the questioning process, I think.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Ben. And thank you to all the panelists for their remarks today. I see a raised hand from Mike Shear at the New York Times. I'm going to ask Mike to unmute first and share his question.
Hey there, guys. Thank you all for doing this. I really appreciate it. Two quick questions. One, one of the debates that's erupted over the last few days is this debate over that the Republicans are insisting that President Biden could have done a lot of these things without any new authorities. So I wonder if you guys could talk about, you know, how much of what's in here is new authority that the president, you know, could not do absent the passage of this law, or how much is stuff that through either executive action or executive orders he could or direct DHS already to do. And then the second question is about the backlogs. I saw several Democratic senators talking about how the you know, processing of asylum would go immediately from 10 years to 6 months. And I wonder if you guys assess that that is in fact true, and if so, what happened to the backlogs? Because there have been efforts to say it would move faster in the past, but those have always run headfirst into the reality of, you know, all of the backlogs that are up there. So even though you try to do it in 180 days, or, you know, how likely is that to actually happen, or is it likely to be years, you know, despite the new mandate? Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Great questions. Let me try at least on that first authority, or the first question of current executive authority to act unilaterally. I mean, look, you don't have to roll the tape back too far when it was Mike Johnson and Donald Trump calling for legislative reform. You know, Donald Trump certainly never passed up an opportunity to exercise executive authority, and perhaps, not my view, overuse executive authority on immigration. And even he was calling for legislative reform, recognizing the limitations on executive authority. So, you know, the idea that the president could accomplish most or all of this through executive authority is just flatly wrong. Quite frankly, the parts of this that he could come close to are the ones that certainly we like the least. 212F authority in U.S. immigration law that the President Trump had used would be even a more blunt instrument than this would be. And the absence of it, again, although there are concerns we have about this alternative asylum infrastructure that got created to attempt some sort of a border closure without any other infrastructure to support it or to recognize that there are asylum seekers attempting to, you know, seek protection from persecution. I mean, that becomes just catastrophic in terms of its the humanitarian outcome. So I think by every measure, constructive solutions using executive authority alone just don't exist in this particular moment. And in terms of the system being able to work fast enough to achieve these objectives, I will say, again, turn over to somebody else to offer a deeper analysis. But what's different here is you're talking about the creation of a separate system. Efforts before to try to speed up the process do run into statutory limitations in terms of sidelining the immigration court system in the adjudication of asylum applications. So under the current law, they have to have a role and they are completely overwhelmed. And although they have tried to sort of move pieces around, they're playing with a half-filled balloon where you try to alleviate one pressure point and it creates another one. So the concept of creating an alternative structure that would be able to speed this up is worthy of consideration, at least. But anyway, sorry, Greg or Andrea or Jeremy, anyone who wants to jump in on either of those two.
I had a little bit, but Ben already gave a really kind of comprehensive kind of answer to Mike, your two questions. One on the topic that Ben was just talking about in terms of can the process suddenly be reduced to 6 months. I think you already know your answer, and that is no, it can't. It won't happen overnight. It's going to take a long time to implement this. The first step that's most obvious is let's get that money out to USCIS to get these asylum officers hired. Before any of this bill even got discussed, Biden was coming to Congress and saying, give me 1,600 more asylum officers to process these cases rapidly. That would already help, even without this bill being implemented, if you could have just given USCIS more resources to do its job effectively. The resource issue also impacts other types of immigration cases that USCIS has to process. And that's why the $4 billion infusion of funds to just USCIS that's included in this bill are so important. AILA did a report just a few months ago where we found that people that are already in line trying to get family-based or employment-based petitions, these are immigration visa petitions that they've applied for, that they're waiting for so long to get those petitions approved that they're resorting to coming to the U.S. southern border. And that's just another example of where the delays in the overall system are resorting or are forcing people to resort to come to the border. And that's why we also need the kinds of legal pathways that we talked about before. One quick note just on the 212F authority that Ben flagged before. There's already been case law about what Mike Johnson was talking about. And the fact is, if the president can't just say, I've got this great power called 212F in the immigration law that allows me to shut down the border and block asylum seekers. A court said, no, there's also asylum law that says you have to give people meaningful access to asylum. And those two laws are in competition. And so already that statement by Johnson is just inaccurate.
Andrea, Jeremy?
Andrea, do you want to go over? Just one quick thing to add.
The only thing I'll say is, just at the very top, Mike, to your question, it depends on what Republicans expect President Biden to do in terms of whether he has the authority. I agree with all the 212F analysis. But I'll go back to what I said. When we say there are steps you can take right now when it comes to cities. I'll point to one of the most successful operations that this administration has overseen, which was Operation Allies Welcome. They mobilized, without new authorities, 70,000 people that they used federal military bases for to provide them temporary housing and work with communities before they resettled. That was an impressive effort that did not require any new powers. And so when we say that there can be an active response to cities, if this bill does not turn into law, they could replicate a success they have already managed. So that is what we will continue to push them to do in terms of executive action.
Great point.
Thanks, Ajay. And the only other, I mean, there are two things, right? What could he do alone? It's what does he have legal authority to do, and what does he have money to do? And you need Congress for both those things. I think one of the failed assumption a little bit in a lot of these statements is it relies so heavily on this idea that, well, we can just prevent instead of processing. But the reality is that people are coming and we need to be able to process. And when you're talking about what the ability to actually process these large numbers, there is much less that they can do without Congress. There are things like Andrea is suggesting, but there are a lot of things in this bill that simply they're again, either there's not the money or there's not the legal authority. So you look at the new faster asylum screening process, like that now gives legal authority to it. You look at the fact that there's now funding for 4,000 new asylum officers. That is something that he just, like Ben said, like they've been asking, or Ben Craig said, they've been asking and haven't been able to get. New visa pathways, the 50,000 visas that relieve some of the pressure. I mean, those are things that this bill allows that simply wouldn't have been there in terms of relieving the pressure. Because the reality that you can just sort of set up a wall and shut down the border, it's been tried over and over again, and it has not been shown to be effective.
All right. Belle, you want me to take over? I think I know the order here.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead, Ben.
All right. Camilo, I'll get you to unmute your phone.
Hey, folks, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Awesome. Okay, so thank you for doing this. I understand your concerns. The bill obviously does not legalize any of the undocumented immigrants here, and the increases in legal immigration are fairly limited. But isn't this the best deal that this administration and Democrats could get right now, given the current political and operational realities here at the border? It certainly seems like this would be hard to imagine in another Trump administration or another Republican administration, this coming together. Is this the best deal that the administration could get right now?
And that's a great question. That might be the $65,000 question of the year. Look, there's no question the political environment right now, you know, constrains what's possible. I will say, given where the political debate is on immigration, everybody needs to be able to be involved in opening up the possibility. So I don't think we can or should live with the political limitations imposed currently. The fact that these folks got in a room together, a Republican, an independent, and a Democrat, and came up with these essential reforms suggests that with more shoulders against this wheel, we might be able to move more. So, you know, we're not going to stop in trying to recognize this as an opportunity and push the limits of what we currently think is politically impossible. I'm not sure I would have thought any of this was possible, 3 months from now. So I do think this suggests that the political spectrum is more movable than we maybe thought that it was. And it's our job, I think, to try to move it in a constructive direction. So anyway, that's my thought on that. But Andrea, Jeremy, Angie, I don't know if you want to weigh in on this as well.
I would just say, as a former Senate staffer, an initial proposal is always just that. It's an initial proposal. And so it is up to experts to inform how this would actually work on the ground. And as we said, without legal pathways, this is not going to be as successful or the best policies that could be passed, even in this political moment. And of course, as Democrats who have championed legalization since the post 9/11 era very consistently, we have to continue to push for that. And that, if that is included, then I think this looks like a real compromise bill. We'd have an entirely different conversation if you saw the DREAM Act attached to legislation like this, because then that would mean that Republicans also came to the table and compromised just as much as we are compromising. And by we, I mean Democrats are compromising on asylum reforms.
All right. Quinn Owen.
Hi, thank you all for coming together to host this call. It's been helpful. I have a couple questions about the summary removal authority. Once it gets triggered, how similar is this process to what we saw under Title 42? And is it at all clear how it will interact with Mexico's immigration enforcement? And is it at all clear whether Mexico will accept these expulsions? And if any insights into how that might work would be helpful. Thank you.
Greg, and then Andrea.
Well, I'll start maybe with the back end in terms of your question, Quinn. So there isn't, at least to my awareness, an agreement yet that's been reached with Mexico about whether it's going to be able to accept people or willing to accept people back if this border expulsion authority is triggered. And I think that is a critical linchpin here that could pose a real problem for implementation. The other aspect of just kind of the Mexican government's involvement that's important is that the Mexican government needs to be able to have a fair process and to provide better protection for the people that are sent back as well. Otherwise, the safety and security of those individuals will continue to be at risk. The one thing I would just flag quickly about how this is different from Title 42 is that it's not really a physical block at the border so much as it is to say that if you come in between ports of entry when the expulsion authority is applied, that you're going to not be eligible for asylum any longer. And yes, you will be expelled quickly. And so that's what makes it different. But I'll stop there.
Yeah, I do think it's pretty significantly different. So one, even in the Title 42 order, and I'm putting my old National Security Council hat on here, there were exemptions and there were some, it provided the opportunity for people to manifest a fear. So the fact that it's codified that is the process is going to actually be slightly more protective in that way. But unlike Title 42 now, this pretty phenomenal change is that there's a codified ports of entry process now. And that is an improvement over Title 42, where we knew that Title 42 ended up becoming an increasing in significant numbers between the ports encounters. But I am concerned that some of the operational efficiencies of Title 42, if you were just looking at the time in custody piece, this is going to require more time in custody for people who come in than Title 42 did, which is why I said at the outset that it is likely to not end the practice of releases with notices to appear, because there's simply not going to be the space for likely several years to process people in the timeline that this legislation sets out. So it will both have more people coming in through ports, and then it will have heightened screenings that will take longer than Title 42 did. But it is significant that it restricts access to asylum protection between ports, which, as we know from Title 42, for 3 years, most of those people ended up, you know, raising asylum as a defense to their removal once their proceedings got started.
Yeah, I agree with that. I want to say that, I mean, I know certainly that in particular Speaker Johnson and House Republicans, you know, they're this simple axiom that they have that you just need to reinstate, you know, MPP or Title 42 like expulsions. And I mean, what is both irresponsible and incorrect about that is that the idea that moving the problem 100 yards south of our border means that it doesn't exist is ridiculous. That is not a solution to the problem. It might aim our cameras a different way. It might, you know, change some of the political dynamics, but that is still a problem at our southern border. And the longer that those kinds of expulsions, with no thought about how to provide avenues of protection for people, and let's be clear, MPP and 212F and Title 42 were only about the expulsion. There was no time, attention, resources, or planning about how do you admit people? How do you honor the arrival of people in that process? So that kind of a one-sided solution, a simple MPP, simple Title 42 kinds of expulsions is ridiculous. The problem still exists. And as those people congregate in Mexico in larger and larger numbers, I mean, you don't have to look very far back to that horrific fire that took 40 something lives in Mexico. Those kinds of humanitarian disasters are what happened. We're not paying attention to the fact that there are people on just a few hundred yards away from our southern border. So that's not a solution. Nick. Mirov, sorry.
Hey, thanks for doing the call. I wanted to ask about particular challenges of dealing with flows or, you know, an influx such as the one we've been seeing from Venezuela. There's a massive amount of money in this bill for ICE, for ERO operations. But what do you do with a country like Venezuela that is once more, you know, threatening to no longer accept removal flights? How should the administration approach countries like that? And, you know, are the potential new, you know, processing mechanisms for asylum seekers going to crash into the reality of, you know, a country like Venezuela that's sending more than 200,000 people a year and basically not taking anyone back, regardless of whether or not, you know, they would qualify?
Great question. Andrea or Greg, you want to answer that?
Yeah, it's a really important question that I think really speaks to something this bill is not going to be able to solve as currently written, right? Which is what happens when countries refuse to take removal flights, which we had seen since the start of this administration, more countries be resistant to a regular cadence of removal flights. So with that said, the administration, I believe, took the right approach initially by creating a parole pathway for Venezuelans, because if you know a population likely has no choice but to come to our border, it is better to create a safer option with work authorization with a private sponsor to allow them to come and temporarily relocate. However, what we have seen throughout the region is that Colombia and other countries that have made commitments to protect and integrate Venezuelans have started to roll back some of those protections. So it's critical that both the US and partners in the region, the only way we manage such a large displacement is that every country that commits to temporarily relocating Venezuelans, we have to take seriously, and this is something that this bill does leave out, the idea that the United States has to fund the integration of migrants in our partner and sort of allied countries as well in the region. That's the only way you prevent what is an unsustainable movement of people. And it's unsustainable, right? Because we know that many Venezuelans started in Colombia and then they lost work or housing and they had to relocate again. And then we saw them relocate all the way up until they reached the United States. And so countries like Brazil have one of the best models that we should learn from, which is that not only are they accepting a steady and regular number of Venezuelans, but they're integrating them and they're actually working with cities and identifying whether it's labor shortage or economic needs with those receiving communities. So there's so many ways we could be resettling that population and, you know, serving as a model for the region about the economic benefits that would come with sort of active resettlement. But instead, as I said at the top, relying on the status quo of expecting a displaced population to come up to the border through a smuggling network is very inefficient. And it also takes operational, you know, resources that Border Patrol needs to respond to other populations that have a very different situation and perhaps come from countries where there could be removal flights. So it's about prioritization of resources and being clear-eyed about our regional sort of burden sharing.
Yeah, and I think those multilateral negotiations, I mean, the availability of visas and authority maybe to include those visas in multilateral negotiations, remittances are a huge benefit to some of these failing economies, and being able to use that as a bargaining chip in negotiating these kinds of relationships and arrangements, you know, could loosen the resistance of places like Venezuela. So if you could use some of these available visas, perhaps create more visas than are provided here, and leverage them to create programs specifically designed to match up labor from Venezuela to the United States, then you've got real dollars flowing back to Venezuela in a way that might change the calculation that's currently driving the resistance to repatriation flights. All right. Any other questions? Any other final comments, Greg, Andrea, Jeremy? All right. I guess I will just say what we said at the outset. I think this there is an opportunity here that I think we all need to take stock of and continue to push our elected leaders to move in a direction that will get us at constructive, comprehensive solutions that'll meet the challenge of the moment that we face now. So thank you all for your interest and coverage of this issue.
Thank you so much. We'll end the call now and we'll share a recording as soon as it's available. Thanks, everyone.